Robin Young is away. It's here and now. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice appeared on 60 Minutes last night to talk about the Bush administration's handling of the war on terror. She provided counterpoint to points made on the same program last Sunday by former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark. Rice was asked about her refusal to testify publicly and under oath before the commission investigating 9/11.
Nothing would be better, from my point of view, than to be able to testify. I would really like to do that, but there's an important principle involved here. It is a long-standing principle that sitting national security advisors do not testify before the Congress.
Today, Republican Commission member John Lehman went on NBC's Today Show to call Rice refusing to testify a political blunder.
I'm saying that it's a blunder because they've got nothing to hide. We've been through the materials. There are no smoking guns, and we need this witness now to help put the full picture together for the American people. We are getting the full picture, and we'll get it, but not the rest of the American people.
Well, joining us on the line from Washington are Andrea Stone, Capitol Hill correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Bill.
And Carl Lubsdorf, Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Hi, Carl.
Glad to be with you, Bill.
Carl, what's your thoughts this Monday morning on the Condoleezza Rice business?
Well, I think that, you know, this is operating on two levels, and I think Commissioner Lehman was correct in the fact that politically the administration is getting beat up pretty badly on this. The argument that's being made here from the White House is not a new one, and we've seen it in many administrations that basically top-level staff people should not be required to testify on the Hill about conversations basically they had with the president that would somehow limit their ability to provide confidential advice.
Although that's not enshrined in the Constitution or anything, it basically started under the Eisenhower administration, this executive privilege idea, right?
And just about every administration to some degree has stood on it.
And I have
some sympathy for it, but this is really a political fight here, and politically they're suffering.
Yeah, yeah. Exceptions, you say, Andrea?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big new Brzezinski under President Carter, and Sandy Berger, when he was National Security Advisor, did make exceptions. And I'm just wondering if there's sort of diminishing returns here for the administration by holding out for this executive privilege. Because, you know, I mean, people have to wonder, well, if she doesn't want to testify publicly under oath, why is she on 60 Minutes? Why is she on every talk show, every news show?
Yeah, I mean, Carl, is there a sense in Washington, what's the buzz along the Potomac as to whether Condoleezza Rice has something to hide, given the fact that she won't go under oath? Or is it really that they're standing on principle? What's the buzz?
I think they're standing on what they believe to be principle. This administration has been very firm on this subject from the very beginning, and I'm not excusing it or condoning or necessarily supporting it, but that's the position they've taken. And the fact is that, you know, their position on most of this is pretty well known. Their argument is pretty well known, and I think the Republicans on the committee probably feel that the White House position has weakened their position within the committee.
The committee is still pushing a bit to get her in front of them, possibly even still under oath. Is it considered in Washington a possibility, Andrew, that that may yet happen?
Well, you know, Tom Keene, who was the Republican chairman of the commission, has been very firm saying that all 10 of the panel members want her to testify. But at the same time, he said, but we're not going to go so far as to subpoena her, which, you know, I think there's just a lot of frustration. I know the families of the 9/11 victims have been very adamant about this. They want her to be out front. I'm not sure that we will. If the White House is standing pat and the commission is not willing to issue a subpoena, we're sort of at loggerheads.
Although also members of the victims of 9/11 families came out and criticized former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark. Speaking of Richard Clark, Carl, still roiling the political waters in Washington this Monday morning is also what Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist called for on Friday, which is to declassify testimony by Clark before a congressional committee in 2002. Frist says the testimony will show Clark to be a hypocrite because in it he's positive about the Bush administration on terror. But Clark threw down the gauntlet yesterday, didn't he? He said, bring it on, declassify it. What are you hearing in Washington about that?
Well, it's interesting. Several Democrats who were on the committee said that there's nothing in there that would be a problem. Senator Frist, in fact, was not on that committee. And from the news accounts I read, apparently he was briefed on the hearings by staff. and then went out and made these charges. Look, we all know that people who work in an administration don't always agree with it, but when they testify in its behalf, they testify, they put the best light on it. Clark, as he said, yes, they undoubtedly tried to put the best face on it from the administration's point of view, but whether it's directly contradictory, I guess we'll only know if the documents come out.
You know, Andrea Clark further throwing down the gauntlet by urging the Bush administration to make public a memo on counterterrorism initiatives he wrote just days after Bush took office, as well as a counterterrorism plan Clark says was there from the start of the Bush administration, but wasn't adopted until September 4th. This is problematic for the Bush administration, isn't it?
It is, but you know, we're hearing all kinds of words.
Or isn't it?
Well, it depends on how you look at it.
Yeah.
You know, there was a new Newsweek poll taken after Clark's testimony last week showed that support for Bush's handling of terrorism has slipped from 65% a month ago to 57% now. But at the same time, two-thirds said that Clark's testimony had not affected their view of the president, and about half, you know, said that they thought that Clark was acting for personal and political reasons. So, you know, I think this is another example of how equally divided the country is, and if you tend to not believe or like the Bush administration, you're going to hear one thing, and vice versa. If you are supportive of the president, you're going to look, you know, look with some suspicion on Richard Clark's testimony.
I look at that poll a little differently because I think the figure that Bush's rating on terrorism went down is far more important than whether people, what they think of Clark, because President Bush is the person who's running for re-election, and one of the main planks in his platform basically is, I, you know, led the country in the war against terrorism.
Exactly, right.
And that's why this is such a big issue. And in the end, if they can tear down Clark's credibility, perhaps they can bolster Bush's, but so far they don't seem to have done that.
And I think it's so interesting. I can't remember the administration going after anybody so ferociously. I mean, the Democrats are talking about character assassination. I think there probably is a connection between how ferociously they're going against Clark and how worried they are about the damage he could do.
And you know what? We may be just getting started. April 14th is the latest publication date I've heard for Bob Woodward's new book, which has not been sanctioned by the Bush White House as his earlier book about Bush at War was, and there's some buzz that this book may be unpleasant for the Bush administration and quite explosive in its own right, right?
Of course, this week we have another book by Karen Hughes,
true,
who is the president's advisor and who's coming back into a more active role in the campaign, so they're going to be doing a little of their own book promotion on the other end.
The dueling million-dollar contract players.
Right.
I want to thank you both. Andrea Stone is Capitol Hill correspondent for USA Today. Thanks, Andrea.
Thanks, Bill.
And Carl Lubsdorf is Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Thanks, Carl.
You're welcome.
At a critical moment for Arab regimes, with more than 100,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, for one thing, Arab diplomats last week converged on Tunis, the Tunisian capital, for a summit meeting of the Arab League. On the agenda was reviving a peace plan for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and discussion of democratic reform. But late Saturday night, as the diplomats were hammering out the details, the host foreign minister got a phone call from his president. When he returned, he told a stunned group, "It's over. There is no summit." Joining us from Washington is Robin Wright. She's diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome, Robin.
Nice to be with you.
Robin, Arab summits have failed to accomplish much in the past, but a full-out collapse like this is unusual and significant, isn't it?
Absolutely. This was to be a critical Arab League summit. There have been important ones in the past that are remembered for changing foreign policy. There was one a couple of years ago when Saudi Arabia issued an initiative that would embrace Israel after all these years of conflict. This one was going to be important because it was going to focus on the issue of democracy and the kind of democratic change that has been so difficult to achieve in the last block of countries to hold out against the democratic tide. And there was basic deadlock.
But at the end of the day, Robin, why couldn't they just sit down and talk about all the stuff you just told us about?
Well, it appears that there was deadlock on the issue of reform. And the interesting thing is that the Tunisians apparently played a very important role, which is notable since the president of Tunisia recently came back from talks in Washington with the Bush administration. And what I am told were some very tough words from President Bush himself, urging reform on Tunisia and urging President Ben Ali to take a key role in pressing for reforms.
Right. You know, interestingly, a week or so ago, you wrote about Saudi Arabia scheduling municipal elections for later this year. Officials there, you write, have even hinted that women may be granted the right to vote. At the same time, and just before Secretary of State Colin Powell arrived, the Saudis arrested a bunch of reformers. Is that kind of a microcosm of the difficulty that Arab regimes have with dealing with the possibility of democratic reform?
Absolutely. In fact, the position taken by Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Egypt is that reforms should be decided by individual countries based on their own cultural norms and social preferences.
Yeah.
And so this gave them the latitude to speak out of both sides of their mouth, as the Saudis have been, and as most of the Arab countries have been for decades.
You know, the group of eight industrialized nations meet in June, and the U.S. was to put forward a greater Middle East initiative. But there was some diplomatic bungling there, wasn't there, because they didn't alert Arab regimes about it. They didn't vet it with the Arab leaders before it leaked out.
Hmm? Well, it was shared with the eight governments that will participate in the G8 summit this June, and one of them clearly had leaked the plan to Al Hayat, an Arab language newspaper. And this led to some disgruntlement. But that really isn't the issue. That's kind of a canard. It's an excuse that the Arab governments can use to criticize the plan that many of them clearly don't want to accept. So tactically, yes, it didn't work very well. But the reforms actually are quite imaginative. The Greater Middle East Initiative is arguably the most ambitious program to promote democracy anywhere in the world since the Helsinki Accords of the 1970s. Which set out barometers by which to judge the East Bloc, the Communist Bloc, and the Greater Middle East Initiative has some ambitious ideas, not just to foster democratic elections, they were to unleash the forces for change. And that's why the United States feels it's so important and why it's so unfortunate that tactically it wasn't handled very well.
Yet, finally, Robin, the real-world barometer will be whether Iraq democratizes, right? And Arab regimes will be watching carefully.
Tremendously important. Great question, Bill. And clearly the United States has a very short period of time, only 3 months now, to help set up an interim government. The process has not gone well over the last 10 months, and it doesn't look like the United States is going to be able to put in place some kind of fully representative body by the time it leaves on June 30th.
Robin Wright, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent for The Washington Post. Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Ariel Sharon's legal troubles. And later in the show, lawmakers in Massachusetts have another try at a constitutional amendment that would ban same-sex marriage. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. The roadmap to peace isn't the only political uncertainty in the Middle East these days. Israel's top prosecutor has recommended now indicting Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon on bribery charges. And the country's Supreme Court is ordering Sharon's son to hand over potentially incriminating documents related to the case. Sharon says he'll stay in office even if the attorney general does hand down official charges. But some say keeping his leadership post during legal proceedings just isn't an option. Molly Moore is covering the story for The Washington Post. She joins us from Jerusalem, and welcome, Molly.
Thank you.
Molly, what's the case against the Sharons, plural, father and son? Boil it down for us.
Well, there are a variety of corruption scandals that have been going on here for several months. The one involving the indictment that was handed down by the chief prosecutor this weekend involves something called the Greek Island Affair. And this was basically a real estate deal. A real estate developer who was very active in Sharon's Likud party was trying to develop a resort in Greece. He allegedly gave one of Sharon's sons a $100,000 salary to be a marketing advisor for this project.
and then, according to the prosecutor, funneled several hundred thousand more dollars to Sharon. And Sharon was foreign minister at the time, and the hope was that Sharon would put in a good word to contacts he had in Greece for this project. In the end, the project did not go through.
What are Sharon's options as prime minister if he's indicted?
The lawyers in this country are debating whether he has to step down. Now, before he can even be indicted, the attorney general of the country has to go to the parliament to get them to lift his immunity as prime minister. Now, this essentially would be a no-confidence vote in Sharon. But what's more important here than the legalities is the court of public opinion. Sharon's polls have been absolutely plummeting in the last year. He's also involved in some very controversial proposals. He's trying to put together a proposal now that would pull Jewish settlements and soldiers out of the Gaza Strip. Now, this proposal is opposed by people within his own party. It's opposed by other political parties here. So legalities aside, what many political analysts here say, what will determine Sharon's future is the court of public opinion and perhaps his standing within his own party.
Who would step in if he stepped out?
Well, this would be the big debate. The two people lining up to try to head the party and head the country would be Benjamin Netanyahu and also the current foreign minister, Sylvain Shalom.
He's scheduled to come to Washington in just a little bit, right?
He is, and this trip was originally designed to try to sell his Gaza withdrawal to the Bush administration. The details of this have not been hammered out at all, and there's some skepticism over this because essentially what he's doing is deciding to cut off negotiations with the Palestinians. He's decided they don't have a viable partner to discuss peace here, and so instead of even continuing to try to work something out in the peace process, he's decided that Israel is going to go it alone with unilateral disengagement. As many of the political analysts out here are saying, the peace process died here months ago. The problem now is even talk of a peace process is dying.
That Sharon trip to Washington was scheduled, still is scheduled, for April 14th. Molly Moore, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Molly Moore is Jerusalem bureau chief for The Washington Post. She joined us from Jerusalem. Well, turning now to the Tyco trial, where the judge this morning disallowed a defense petition for a mistrial, saying a mistrial would be inappropriate at this time. The jury's in its eighth day of deliberations after nearly 6 months of grueling court proceedings. Former Tyco CEO Dennis Kozlowski and the firm's former chief financial officer Mark Swartz are charged with corruption, including defrauding the company of some $600 million. Joining us on the line from New York City is Nanette Burns, senior writer for Newsweek. Nanette, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Nanette, the deliberations go on. What did defense attorneys base their call for a mistrial on?
Well, in the newspapers here in New York this weekend, there was a lot of coverage of this apparent flashing of an okay sign by one of the jurors towards the defense table, indicating perhaps some solidarity with their case. And the lawyers were arguing that you can't have a fair trial, you can't have fair jury deliberations if one juror seems to be so, out of sync with the rest and apparently having a feeling of ostracism.
And what do we know about this juror?
Well, there has been a lot written about this person. I believe that she was interviewed today by the judge in the case. It's kind of a tricky situation to talk too much about her because there's a real criticism of the press for kind of outing her identity here. But she seems to be an affluent person from the Upper East Side who has a strong opinion on this.
Nanette, how likely is it that the defense will reach a verdict in this case?
Well, it looks pretty questionable, I would say, that the jury will come to any solution. I mean, they've been deliberating for 8 days now. There's been a series of notes coming out of the jury room saying that they can't come to any sort of decent deliberation or really any conclusion on what they've talked about so far. This is only more controversy and perhaps further separating the jurors from one another.
Yeah, and besides personal problems seemingly among the jurors, there is a fundamental issue here. They seem to be stuck, many commentators believe, on the issue of criminal intent. What can you tell me about that?
Right. A lot of the questions coming out of the jury room early in the deliberations did focus on this. They were asking for testimony and information about this. It's the question of whether or not these two executives intended to steal, whether in their heart they were trying to defraud the company. If they can't prove, if they haven't proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that these two executives were trying to steal, they may not be able to come up with a verdict against them.
Yeah, although we should point out that in one of those notes sent from the jury, they said, we are not a hung jury.
That's right. They actually have continued to maintain that they feel they could come to a solution, but a later note argued that one juror was refusing to engage in constructive negotiation and discussion.
Nanette Burns is a senior writer for Businessweek, not Newsweek, as I said earlier. I apologize for that, Nanette.
That's okay.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Advocates and opponents of gay marriage are once again turning their eyes toward Massachusetts. Today, state lawmakers are one step closer to approving a constitutional ban on gay marriage. The ban, however, would legalize civil unions. Well, WBUR reporter Audie Carnish is at the Massachusetts State House now. Hi, Audie.
Hi, Bill.
Audie, surprisingly swift development on Boston's Beacon Hill today. What exactly happened?
Well, the last time state legislators met, they gave preliminary approval to an amendment proposal to the state constitution that would, while banning same-sex marriage, establish civil unions. Now, in sort of the next phase of the voting, they've come up with another draft version of that amendment that got preliminary approval, and this proposal is a little bit different in that while it bans same-sex marriage and establishes civil union, it's got a line in it that says that they do this while recognizing that, quote, under present federal law, same-sex persons and civil unions will be denied federal benefits available to married persons. So they're basically saying, look, we're going to do what we can, but the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and ban against same-sex marriage will prevent you from getting all the benefits you expect to under a marriage that heterosexuals would have.
Huh. So the legislature voted, and sooner than anyone expected, but this is far from the end of the story, even in the legislature, right?
Yes, and to be completely honest, there's a lot of maneuvering going on. The vote they took today was procedural in some ways, and they're even going to reconsider. So actually, after I get off the phone with you, they may take a vote that could reverse this second phase of approval. And so they're taking their lunch hour to go back and forth office to office and really working the phones to try and get people on one side or another. Both extremes, the anti-same-sex marriage folks and the pro-same-sex marriage folks, are against any amendment. And they're really working hard to take away votes from anything that could pass and get before voters in 2006.
Because ultimately it still has to go to the voters.
Ultimately, it still has to go to the voters. Anything that gets approval today would have to go through another three procedural votes. So it is a very long day that we're going to have, and they've scheduled to go 3 days for this particular session. Again, the clock is ticking. May 17th is when the state Supreme Judicial Court's ruling that allows same-sex couples to get marriage licenses will take effect. And several lawmakers have got up today and said outright, look, we've got to pass something to prevent legal chaos in May.
Well, the backdrop to this, as you say, is that the Massachusetts Supreme Court has said it's unconstitutional to ban same-sex marriages. And most everyone in this state, including the governor, it seems, expects them to start happening in May.
It is. And so a lot of the discussion going on with these different amendments is how can we craft something that will, A, provide some sort of benefits, and B, prevent couples who get benefits in May from having them stripped later on. And so a lot of people, no matter what side they're on, do seem to be concerned about the benefits angle of it. But no one can really agree on how to get there.
Governor Mitt Romney here in Massachusetts, just to quickly finish up, has considered trying to prevent the marriages from happening in May, right? Where does that stand?
He has, but, you know, he really hasn't been clear on how we would do that, and I don't think anyone is. On the one hand, people have unearthed a residency clause that says out-of-state couples cannot get marriage licenses in Massachusetts if they'd be otherwise banned from doing so in their own state. So maybe that will prevent an influx of folks from coming in from all over. On the other hand, he could ask for a stay or an injunction of the ruling. But the fact is, the state Supreme Judicial Court gave lawmakers just 180 days. It really doesn't look like they were offering a lot of maneuvering or wiggle room.
WBUR reporter Audie Cornish at the Massachusetts State House. Thanks, Audie.
Thank you.
Well, construction workers cheered today as the northbound lanes of Interstate 95 in Connecticut reopened. An oil tanker fire that literally melted a bridge had closed the highway in both directions last Thursday, causing massive traffic delays. It will be months before repairs are completed, and the disruptions expected to have economic reverberations throughout the region. Now, last week was an accident, but how vulnerable is our highway system to terrorism? Tony Kane is the Director of Engineering and Technical Services for the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you.
Tony, how vulnerable are our highways to terrorist attack?
Well, there's about 500,000 bridges and tunnels in the country, but if you take a look at what the most critical ones are, we're probably down to 500 to 600 structures and tunnels in this country that are of most concern because of their large traffic volume, high cost, or serious economic impact, should they be taken out of service.
How difficult would it be in general for a terrorist to take out of service a major bridge or tunnel?
Well, without revealing trade secrets, there's a lot of vulnerability depending upon the structure type, whether you're a suspension bridge, a truss bridge, different vulnerabilities in terms of the columns and piers and the water to some trusses and spans. And we're looking at a variety of ways to shore up the vulnerability of those structures and really to deter ever having terrorist attacks on them in the first place is probably the greatest thing we could do.
But could a relatively low-tech terrorist cause a lot of damage?
The potential is there, yes.
You talk about choke points. Tell me about that.
Well, choke points, I think a pretty good example would be the high corridor facilities that don't have alternatives. If you have a facility that may have 150 to 200,000 vehicles a day on them, which is not uncommon in many of the larger cities in this country, without alternatives to that, you can really tie up traffic and the economy of an area, and we really look at those as vulnerability choke points because the commercial freight would be held up in terms of being able to get from port to its inland or into ports, as well as the commuter traffic. And those are particularly vulnerable because of the high traffic volumes.
And it's a lot more expensive to fix or rebuild a bridge that's been damaged than to shore up its strength right now, right?
Oh, you're absolutely right. Replacing a major structure could be, depending upon the structure, anywhere from $500 million to $2 billion.
Tony, what's your sense of how much emphasis the Department of Homeland Security has put on this particular aspect of homeland security?
I'd have to say pretty minimal. I think from two fronts. One, perhaps a feeling that transportation in terms of tunnels and structures may not be as prone to attack as many feel that you may have. In fact, since 9/11, we know of some threats that have been stopped in some structures in this country. And the potential is really large for major tunnels or structures. And so I think we feel collectively as owners of the major facilities, the State Departments of Transportation, that we haven't gotten the attention we deserve from Homeland Security. And on the second front, on emergency response, we also feel that much more concern has to be given to transportation as first responders. We think since 911, most of the funding has gone to the police, fire, emergency medical. But when you think about it, they can't operate unless they're in good communication with the facilities that they have to move and operate on. In 911, you had to be able to direct police, fire, emergency medical downtown. You had to be able to evacuate the people from downtown in order for the city to keep running. And so we feel, as transportation providers, we haven't gotten a fair shake from Homeland Security in terms of being considered first responders.
Tony Kane of the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. Tony, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Still to come, Literature of the Misanthrope 101. You're listening to Here and Now. Just 138 days remain before the Summer Olympics begin in Athens, Greece. But fewer than half the Olympic facilities are finished. And last week, the organizing committee canceled plans to build a roof over the swimming pool, which will now remain uncovered in the blistering August heat of Athens. Wednesday, the largest labor union in Greece plans a day-long strike, threatening to further disrupt construction. But as opening day draws closer, organizers insist they're not worried. Joining us on the line now is Reuters reporter Brian Williams, who's based in Athens. He's joining us today from Switzerland. Welcome, Brian.
Hello, Bill.
Brian, 15 of 35 facilities completed. And that doesn't include transportation upgrades needed in the city. There's apparently a lack of greenery around the venues. Does it all matter? Will Athens be ready?
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, the preparations are on a knife edge. Nobody can argue about that. But there's many, many uncertainties ahead. But I do think that there are three certainties. One, the Games will take place this year. Two, they will take place at Athens. And three, they will take place at the opening ceremony on August the 13th.
You know, some have said this happens to every Olympics every time and not to worry. What's been the biggest problem, the biggest holdup?
I think, frankly, Bill, that it's almost that Greece bit off more than it could chew. It was too ambitious in its planning. What they attempted to do was not only make over the city for an Olympic Games, but make over a European capital whose infrastructure had been neglected for decades, which is where, basically, I think, they ran into the problem they're in at the moment. They're trimming back projects all the time, but frankly, they probably never should have aimed for the scale of the games they plan to put on.
Huh. Speaking of pulling back on projects, a roofless pool in the scalding heat of summer in Athens, how's that going to affect the Olympic swimmers?
Well, I think that, most of the international swimmers that I've spoken to since then, they're not overly concerned. Obviously, they'd probably rather there was some sort of roof. But a lot of them say that they actually hold their own national championships in outdoor pools. There'll obviously be some hot feet as they walk to the starting blocks. But they don't see it as a major problem.
Has the need, perhaps more than any Olympics ever, Brian, to protect against possible terrorist attacks been a reason for some of the delays, or how much has that complicated all this?
Frankly, Bill, I don't think it has.
Okay.
I mean, it's added an enormous amount to the price of the games. Athens is going to have three times as many security people as Sydney did. But the security worry is a knock-on from the lack of the venues being ready, because until the venues are ready, the security people can't put in their communication equipment, they can't test systems. But I think it's simply, that's a knock-on effect. If there hadn't been a September 11, I think that probably Greece would still be in the bind it's in at the moment.
Still good to hear you think the Greeks will bring it off. Brian Williams, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bill.
Brian Williams, the Athens correspondent for Reuters. He joined us from Switzerland. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Delaney, it's here and now. Plenty of popular books, films, and plays are populated by lovable, sympathetic characters. But what about those despicable voices? The ones who think and say unconscionable, ugly things. Things you might think, but would never allow yourself to utter out loud. I'm thinking of Ignatius Riley in A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole, or Albert Smith in the novels of Louis Begley. Even the Grinch. Well, according to our literary critic Steve Almond, the world of letters would be a pretty boring place without these curmudgeons, and he joins me in the studio to talk about a genre he calls misanthropic lit. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Bill.
So, Steve, these misanthropes might be loveless, but are they actually unlovable?
Not to me. Misery loves company, and I think hatred loves company even more. There's something perversely and secretly gratifying about seeing these characters who will say anything. They're equal opportunity haters and oppressors.
They're just insecure. They want to be loved.
That's precisely it, but it's the outer shell of pure hostility.
Right.
That, I mean, if you look at the culture, Bill, we're heavily invested as a culture in hostility, and it's very liberating, again, in a way that's quite dark but honest.
Why do these characters make such good narrators?
Well, I think there are actually a couple of things that we've sort of hinted at. The first is they'll say anything. They tell the truth. They are truth tellers. They're not trying to be politically correct or say the right thing, which is, it's very gratifying to get a straight story. That's why we go to art, you know, literature. The other thing is that there is the redemptive possibility of getting beneath that hatred of mankind to whatever sort of distorted love lives beneath it. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's a good segue into the first book I want to read from, which is a new novel called Project X by a writer named Jim Shepard. I am not a fast reader, Bill, as you watch me sound out the words in the studio. Very slow reader. I read this book in a single day, and then I reread it. You can't take your eyes off the page. It's about a kid named Edwin Hanratty, who is a very misanthropic eighth grader. I'm going to give you a little indication of his voice, although I should mention that I'll be using sort of an abbreviation rather than the swear word. The virgin listener will want to know that Edwin sometimes speaks in curses. Everybody's in a group. Everybody spends all their time thinking about their group or how they want to be in a different group. It's a big S pile with everybody S-ing downward, so you want to be as high as possible. On top are the jocks, though not all jocks. If you only do cross country, you might as well be on the chess team. Next to the jocks are kids they call the Buffies because they look like they came off TV. First day of seventh grade, Flake and I were in homeroom and a girl said to him about this new guy, "He's so angel." The guy was good looking and had that gunk in his hair, and Flake said back to her, "I have no idea what you're talking about." Behind the Buffies are the school spirit types, the ones who organize the cookie drives and theme dances and administration appreciation days. Behind them, the kids who play music in the band. Behind them, the other jock, the track teams, and the guys who swim the 12,000-mile race and stuff like that. Behind them, the artsy types. Behind them, the kids that are good at something real, like math or writing. Behind them, the theater kids. Behind them, the rebels. Behind them, the druggies. Behind them, the kids nobody notices. Behind them, the screw-ups. Behind them, the geeks. Behind them, the kids from the sticks, the trailer types. Behind them, the retards and kids with missing jaws and crap. Behind them, us. Ours is a group of two. So you get a little indication. That's the hardcore 14-year-old misanthrope in all of us.
There's such an energy in a misanthrope, even an eighth-grade misanthrope's words. What's the book about, Project X by Jim Shepard?
Well, sadly enough, this misanthropic energy is actually directed toward what I'll call a violent culmination, a la Columbine, although I have to say that the book does not rely on or refer to Columbine barely at all. It's really very much a book about adolescence and the way in which we experience the world, the hatred and love for the world so intensely at that time, feel so insecure about everything. And I'll say that I guess the nearest cognate would be maybe A Catcher in the Rye, which is another misanthropic character where we see over the course of the book, we get to dig beneath that hatred and see that it's really a distorted form of actually very deep love for the world.
There are no classics about eighth-grade goody-goodies that I know of.
No, thank God. It wouldn't be a very interesting book. It would be a young adult book. The next character I want to talk about, John Self, is, I am happy to say, never redeemed, and joyfully never redeemed. He remains absolutely hateful and despicable throughout the course of this wonderful book, which is called Money, by the writer Martin Amis. He's best known as the writer of, oh gosh, a lot of books, The Information and the Rachel Papers. This book is very much about Reagan's America and Maggie Thatcher's Britain. and about the sort of hateful, vile culture. And John Self is a movie guy. He's in the movie industry. I'm just going to read a very brief excerpt, but it remains this bitter and hard-bitten over the course of the book. God damn it. I have this anti-talent for cues. He's British, so he means lines. You know the deal. Ho, 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 I think, as I successfully shoulder and trample my way to the end of the shortest line. But the shortest line is the shortest line for an interesting reason. The people ahead of me are all Venusians, pterodactyls, men and women from an alternative time stream. They all have to be vivisected and body-bagged by the unsmiling 300-pounder in his lit glass box. Business or pleasure, this guy eventually asked me. I hope business only, I said, and meant it. With business, I'm usually okay. It's pleasure that gets me into all this expensive trouble. Then a half hour in customs and another half before I firmed up this cab. Yeah, and the usual maniac fizzing and crackling at its wheel. I've driven in New York 5 blocks and you're reduced to tears of barbaric nausea. So what happens to these throwbacks when they hire to do it all day for money? You try it.
Of course, it's also still always about good writing. Martin Amis is usually bitter and vitriolic in anything he's written. Yes. He's got that misanthropic edge, but his latest novel was largely panned.
Well, you know, I say this as a writer. Sometimes you're on, sometimes you're not, and taste is indefensible. What I will say is that money is a sort of secret joy. I actually wanted to talk about a book. Here's the dirty truth here. I wanted to talk about a book called The Epicure's Lament for this segment, which is a new novel and a very good novel by a writer named Kate Christensen. But as I was reading The Epicure's Lament, I kept hearing the echo of John Self, who's the character in Money, and he's... In a certain way, he's so much better a misanthrope. He's so much more uncompromising about his hatred. And so I just said, why not just go to the source? Although I definitely recommend The Epicure's Lament by Kate Christensen as well.
What a brilliant name for a misanthrope, John Self.
Yes, and in fact, it figures into the plot prominently. And if you're somebody who has ambivalent or even hateful attitudes towards Hollywood, I don't know why you would, but if you do, say, this is a great book. It is one of the greatest satires of the vapidity of that particular industry that you'd hope to find.
Steve, the fact is, whether it's the devil as opposed to the angel in Milton's Paradise Lost, yes, or these books, we identify with people who are angry.
Yeah, I think that's actually really true.
Or even evil.
Yeah. Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, who's the most, to me, the sort of most powerful characters in Shakespeare? You know, are Iago, you know, Lady Macbeth. These are characters who are angry. They have an agenda. And I want to say that most good literature boils down to trouble. And, you know, you don't find the people who are trying to follow the rules either in spirit or in deed. You know, they're not the ones who make trouble. It's the misanthropes, the troublemakers, the people who speak their mind, even if it's controversial or even gets them into danger.
And the fact is, most of us in eighth grade, and most of us in the 80s when everybody else was getting rich, weren't popular in eighth grade and weren't getting rich in the 80s.
And even if we are externally popular or rich or so forth, these characters tend to tap into the sort of bottomless grievance that most people feel. They're getting ripped off. They say they would let the pedestrian pass in front of them in the street. But truth be told, when that pedestrian is walking along, they just want to mow him down. And that's, to some extent, good literature is able to take a character like that, have us be entertained by our own foibles and our own hatred, and hopefully, by the end, cure us of it.
The very genial Here and Now literary critic Steve Almond is also the author of a forthcoming book about a hardly misanthropic topic. It's called Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. Steve, thanks a lot for coming in.
Always terrible to be here, though.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again here and now. I wanna destroy you.
upon the media and everything you need.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. Join